The Synthesis of Yoga, Sri Aurobindo. Continuing with Part 2, The Yoga of Integral Knowledge, and the chapter on the soul and its liberation, page 440, the bottom of page 440. The cause of our world existence is not, as our present experience induces us to believe, the ego. For the ego is only a result and a circumstance of our mode of world existence. It is a relation which the many-souled Purusha has set up between individualized minds and bodies, a relation of self-defense and mutual exclusion and aggression in order to have among all the dependencies of things in the world upon each other a possibility of independent mental and physical experience. But there can be no absolute independence upon these planes. Impersonality, which rejects all mental and physical becoming, is therefore the only possible culmination of this exclusive movement. So only can an absolutely independent self-experience be achieved. The soul then seems to exist absolutely, independently in itself. It is free in the sense of the Indian word svadhina, dependent only on itself, not dependent upon God and other beings. Therefore, in this experience, God, personal self, and other beings are all denied, cast away as distinctions of the ignorance. It is the ego, recognizing its own insufficiency and abolishing both itself and its contraries, that its own essential instinct of independent self-experience may be accomplished. For it finds that its effort to achieve it by relations with God and others is afflicted throughout with a sentence of illusion, vanity, and nullity. It ceases to admit them because, by admitting them, it becomes dependent on them. It ceases to admit its own persistence, because the persistence of ego means the admission of that which it tries to exclude as not self, of the cosmos and other beings. The self-annihilation of the Buddhist is in its nature absolute exclusion of all that the mental being perceives. The self-immersion of the Advaitin in his absolute being is the self-same aim differently conceived. Both are a supreme self-assertion of the soul of its exclusive independence of Prakriti. The experience which we first arrive at by the sort of shortcut to liberation, which we have described as the movement of withdrawal, assists this tendency. For it is a breaking of the ego and a rejection of the habits of the mentality we now possess. For that is subject to matter and the physical senses, and conceives of things only as forms, objects, external phenomena, and as names which we attach to those forms. We are not aware directly of the subjective life of other beings except by analogy. From our own and by inference or derivative perception based upon their external signs of speech, action, etc., which our minds translate into the terms of our own subjectivity. When we break out from ego and physical mind into the infinity of the spirit, we still see the world and others as the mind has accustomed us to see them, as names and forms. Only in our new experience of the direct and superior reality of spirit, they lose that direct objective reality and that indirect subjective reality of their own, which they had to the mind. They seem to be quite the opposite of the truer reality we now experience. Our mentality, stilled and indifferent, no longer strives to know and make real to itself those intermediate terms which exist in them as in us, and the knowledge of which has for its utility to bridge over the gulf between the spiritual self and the objective phenomena of the world. We are satisfied with the blissful, infinite impersonality of a pure spiritual existence. Nothing else, and nobody else, any longer matters to us. What the physical senses show to us, and what the mind perceives and conceives about them, and so imperfectly and transiently delights in, seems now unreal and worthless. We are not and do not care to be in possession of the intermediate truths of being through which these things are enjoyed by the One, and possess for Him that value of His being and delight which makes, as we might say, cosmic existence a thing beautiful to Him and worth manifesting. We can no longer share in God's delight in the world. On the contrary, it looks to us as if the eternal has degraded itself by admitting into the purity of its being the gross nature of matter, or had falsified the truth of its being by imagining vain names and unreal forms. Or else, if we perceive at all that delight, it is with a far-off detachment which prevents us from participating in it with any sense of intimate possession, or it is with an attraction to the superior delight of an absorbed and exclusive self-experience which does not allow us to stay any longer in these lower terms than we are compelled to stay by the continuance of our physical life and body. But if either in the course of our yoga or as the result of a free return of our realized self upon the world and a free repossession of its prakriti by the Purusha in us, we become conscious not only of the bodies and outward self-expression of others, but intimately of their inner being, their minds, their souls, and that in them of which their own surface minds are not aware. Then we see the real being in them also, and we see them as selves of our self, and not as mere names and forms. They become to us realities of the eternal. Our minds are no longer subject to the delusion of trivial unworthiness or the illusion of unreality. The material life loses indeed for us its old absorbing value, but finds the greater value which it has for the divine Purusha. Regarded no longer as the sole term of our becoming, but as merely having a subordinate value in relation to the higher terms of mind and spirit, it increases by that diminution instead of losing in value. We see that our material being, life, nature, are only one poise of the Purusha in relation to its Prakriti, and that their true purpose and importance can only be appreciated when they are seen not as a thing in itself, but as dependent on higher poises by which they are supported. From those superior relations, they derive their meaning and, therefore, by conscious union with them, they can fulfill all their valid tendencies and aims. Life then becomes justified to us and no longer stultified by the possession of liberated self-knowledge. This larger integral knowledge and freedom liberates in the end and fulfills our whole existence. When we possess it, we see why our existence moves between these three terms of God, ourselves, and the world. We no longer see them, or any of them, in opposition to each other, inconsistent, incompatible, nor do we, on the other hand, regard them as terms of our ignorance, which all disappear at last into a pure, impersonal unity. We perceive their necessity as terms rather of our self-fulfillment, which preserve their value after liberation, or rather find then only their real value. We have no longer the experience of our existence as exclusive of the other existences, which make up, by our relations with them, our experience of the world. In this new consciousness, they are all contained in ourselves and we in them. They and we are no longer so many mutually exclusive egos, each seeking its own independent fulfillment or self-transcendence and ultimately aiming at nothing else. They are all the eternal and the self, and each secretly embraces all in itself and seeks, in various ways, to make that higher truth of its unity apparent and effective in its terrestrial being. Not mutual exclusiveness, but mutual inclusiveness is the divine truth of our individuality. Love the higher law, and not an independent self-fulfillment. The Purusha, who is our real being, is always independent and master of Prakriti. And at this independence, we are rightly seeking to arrive. That is the utility of the egoistic movement and its self-transcendence. But its right fulfillment is not in making absolute the ego's principle of independent existence, but in arriving at this other highest poise of the Purusha with regard to its Prakriti. There is transcendence of nature, but also possession of nature, perfect fulfillment of our individuality, but also perfect fulfillment of our relations with the world and with others. Therefore, an individual salvation in heavens beyond, careless of the earth, is not our highest objective. The liberation and self-fulfillment of others is as much our own concern. We might almost say our divine self-interest as our own liberation. Otherwise, our unity with others would have no effective meaning. To conquer the lures of egoistic existence in this world is our first victory over ourselves. To conquer the lure of individual happiness in heavens beyond is our second victory. To conquer the highest lure of escape from life and a self-absorbed bliss in the impersonal infinity is the last and greatest victory. Then are we rid of all individual exclusiveness and possessed of our entire spiritual freedom. The state of the liberated soul is that of the Purusha who is forever free. Its consciousness is a transcendence and an all-comprehending unity. Its self-knowledge does not get rid of all the terms of self-knowledge, but unifies and harmonizes all things in God and in the divine nature. The intense religious ecstasy, which knows only God and ourselves and shuts out all else, is only to it an intimate experience which prepares it for sharing in the embrace of the divine love and delight around all creatures. A heavenly bliss, which unites God and ourselves and the blessed, but enables us to look with a remote indifference on the unblessed and their sufferings, is not possible to the perfect soul. For these also are its selves. Free individually from suffering and ignorance, it must naturally turn to draw them also towards its freedom. On the other hand, any absorption in the relations between self and others and the world, to the exclusion of God and the beyond, is still more impossible. And therefore, it cannot be limited by the earth or even by the highest and most altruistic relations of man with man. Its activity, or its culmination, is not to efface and utterly deny itself for the sake of others, but to fulfill itself in God possession, freedom, and divine bliss, that in and by its fulfillment others too may be fulfilled. For it is in God alone, by the possession of the divine only, that all the discords of life can be resolved. And therefore, the raising of men towards the divine is, in the end, the one effective way of helping mankind. All the other activities and realizations of our self-experience have their use and power, but in the end, these crowded sidetracks, or these lonely paths, must circle round to converge into the wideness of the integral way by which the liberated soul transcends all, embraces all, and becomes the promise and the power of the fulfillment of all in their manifested being of the divine. And so ends the reading of chapter 18, The Soul and Its Liberation, on page 445.